Human.
Hi there, friends. I'm Michael Goldberg with our weekly mix of words and music. It's Stay Human, so usually it includes laughter and tears in the same hour. But next Saturday morning at 9 a.m., we'll be live in the studio with our semi-occasional call-in joke show with Gail Otteson and Frieda Hall. Join us then to start the day out laughing. Coming up in this hour, stories and poetry of loss. Leah Horton traces her dad's death journey, and Matthew Miltich tells a fable of reincarnation. We'll start with this from Southern Minnesota poet Henry Panovich, Parting Sorrow.
My sister and I were young in Germany, a country made fertile by tears. We grow old together in America, a land of unexpected dreams. When I was a little boy, very sick, my sister tracked 6 hours for my medication, winter day. She came home, shivering, red-faced. She fell asleep on a hard wooden chair. After her son left, her husband died. She lived alone on the farm. From then on, her window of intimacy never opened very far. She became a black iris, never fully opening to my light. In the last part of her life, she became so good at hiding, she forgot to seek. She could be as frustrating as a marble walnut to a hungry squirrel. I stopped looking for her too. When you're on the ladder of old age, the cold sunshine of loss thaws you. Sometimes your sister has to die before you realize how deeply you love. Now, on a windy winter day, I trudge over frozen prairie soil. Round-shouldered, I stand by her stone and give her my warm tears.
Henry Panovich. Up next from Bemidji, my friend Jim Gallagher offered us this story, Old Hunters.
I had a Labrador Retriever years ago that had reached his final years. He moved slowly and stiffly in the morning. His eyes weren't quite as bright as when he was a younger dog. At that age, I no longer sent him on any cold water retrieves or took him on ground-pounding pheasant hunts. But he still had the heart of a hunter. He couldn't stand to be left behind when he saw me with my gun headed for the door. So I found different ways to get him out in the field that wouldn't require days of recuperation on his part. On a warm fall day, early in the duck season, I took the old dog out in my canoe for a morning hunt. I helped him into the bow of the canoe and coaxed him to lay down while I slid into the stern. He had spent many hours in a canoe with me in his 12 years of life, and he knew how the craft moved and bobbed in the water. As a pup, he had slept under my canoe seat on his first canoe trips. Now, at 80 pounds, he held the bow down with his weight and rested his chin on the gunwale. I paddled with my shotgun between my knees. We had hunted ducks for a dozen seasons in this same way. Ahead, a duck flushed off the water and came flying our way. I swung my gun and dropped the bird. The old dog perked up at the shot and started to whine at the sight of it on the water. With a couple of paddle strokes, I turned the canoe towards the duck. The old dog was beside himself and began yipping as I paddled toward the duck. I moved the bow of the canoe alongside the duck so he could reach down and pluck it out of the water. Water dripped off his muzzle and the duck that he held. He was just as excited by this highly assisted chauffeured retrieve as any of the many retrieves he completed as a dog in his prime. The simple act, however throttled down, gave him purpose and tapped into some deep dog emotion steeped into his breed. He was where he was supposed to be, at my side with a bird in his mouth. This was all that mattered. When I think about that morning hunt more than 30 years ago, I see my own future as a hunter in that simple act of paddling an old dog to pick up a duck from the water. Except I will be the old one in the bow of the canoe. Now, nearing 70 years of age, I still hunt upland birds, ducks, and deer. I give my fall days purpose by the rituals of walking in the woods or paddling the marshes of where I call home. I'll get up before dawn or come home after dark, but I expect less of myself. I no longer feel the need to venture out in a blinding snowstorm. I've done that. I know how it feels to have snow melt and drip down my back. Maybe this is wisdom, but it's mixed with an equal part of just giving myself a break. I no longer feel the need to bring home something from every hunt. I measure success by the beauty of the sunrise or in the otter that swam through my decoys. But like my old dog, I still get excited by downing a single duck.
Thanks to Jim Gallagher.
Wish I could read the minds of women. Wish I had gills for swimming. Wish I had movie star looks. I wish I knew every trick in the book. I'd like to feel first love again and be 20 years younger. But the greatest wish I want to come true, I want my dog to live longer. Wish I was the king of rock and roll. Wish I was cool and in the know. And I wish I'd rope blowing in the wind. I'd like to see my late mother again. I'd like to stop poverty, save this world from hunger. But the greatest wish, oh, I want to come through. I want my dog to live longer. I want my dog to live longer. 'Cause when he goes, I'll be blue. And if I had the power, oh, I'd have him live as long as me and you. 'Cause God's got a reason for everything. And in the Lord I trust. But this ain't right. God needs to see the light. 'Cause dogs don't live long enough. He cheers me up, oh, when I'm sad. He's the best friend I've ever had. And I don't care where his nose has been. I let him lick my face again and again. His love is unconditional. And that just makes me stronger. So the greatest wish I want to come true, I want my dog to live longer. Oh, the greatest wish I want to come true, I want my dog to live longer.
That's Carlos Salgado. It's our last stop edition of Stay Human. Up next, from Silvi Spiritus near Finlayson, Minnesota, storyteller Leah Horton.
Dad, what are you doing here? My youngest sister and I were seated at a Thai restaurant in St. Paul, catching up over a shared meal when our dad entered, scanned the room until he saw us, then walked straight over with purpose, feigning surprise at this wild coincidence of bumping into each other when he arrived at our table. I saw the whole act unfold and wasn't the least bit surprised nor pleased by his appearance. I was annoyed.
Well, I just happened to come in and...
No, you didn't. I cut him off. Are you okay? Why are you here?
Well, I was in the area, and when I saw Claire's car outside, I figured I would just...
You would crash her dinner? You had no idea who she was with. What if she was on a date? She deserves privacy. We talked about this. This is not okay.
I hated speaking to my dad like this. It was both shaming and infantilizing. He taught me better than this. But I needed to be clear, and I didn't know how else in this moment to make my point. He had crossed a boundary. This version of Dad, the man who was muddying appropriate boundaries with his adult children, was not the dad any of us had been raised by. Same man, different guy. That dad was reliable and steady. He was big on boundaries and respectful of our privacy, but he let us know that he loved us unconditionally, and he showed up for the important things, events, performances, games. But grief dances with people in strange ways. And when his mother, our beloved grandmother, passed away that year, Dad started behaving erratically. We began to notice a pattern. When he didn't get regular attention from his four kids, he would get weird and then end up in the hospital for one reason or another. 12 multi-day hospital stays in 1 year after his mother died, each one requiring his children to drop everything and go to the hospital. At first, it was frightening. Then, it became frustrating. Then, exhausting. We would divvy up rotations. Dad's at St. Joe's, who's taking this one? Until finally some kids stopped attending altogether. Showing up or not, communicating about it or not, caused rifts among the four of us kids. And when we became more and more familiar with the hospitals and his symptoms and the outcomes, we developed a shorthand that we'd declare up front to the skeptical staff. Please put him in a room with a window that has a view. If you don't, he experiences hospital delirium, and then he'll be here even longer, and believe me, you don't want him here after day three. Please check his electrolytes. We already know that he has cancer, so you don't have to try to gently break that to us. No, I'm sorry, you can't give him an MRI to rule out causes because his pacemaker isn't MRI compatible. The hospitalizations started to feel punitive. If all four of us weren't going to call him every day and show up weekly to have dinner with him, he would make us show up by other means. Every single thing he was experiencing physiologically was real. He wasn't faking. But it's as if grief had taken the captain's chair in his brain and was mashing all the control buttons with wild abandon. During a brief time of clarity between hospital stays, we had insisted that our dad connect with us via Find My Friends, an iPhone app that allows whomever you give permission to see your location pinned on a map. It shows when you're moving and what direction you're moving in. If Dad was going to get weird or black out again, we'd need to know where we could find him. He only agreed to this arrangement if he was allowed to see our location, too. He started tracking our whereabouts obsessively. I finally disengaged from the app and no longer allowed him to see where I was. If you want to know where I am, Dad, you can call me and ask. He was put out, which led to this awful moment in the Thai restaurant with my little sister. He was still following her, and so he showed up unannounced, not knowing she was with me. Busted. The few years between that moment and January of 2022 are all a bit fuzzy now. They're a version of my dad I am actively choosing to forget. The man who had been my lighthouse all of my life suddenly became the jagged rocks upon which the lighthouse stood, equal parts foundational and damaging. Then, in January of 2022, Dad's cancer diagnosis was declared terminal. After the latest round of chemo, the prostate cancer he had lived with for over 10 years had suddenly, aggressively spread to his lymph nodes and his brain. His doctor said he had anywhere from 2 months to 2 years. Dad insisted he would be an outlier on the side of longevity. He started taking seizure medication, and all of the hospital shenanigans stopped. He was clear of mind and spirit, and he had returned to his usual loving boundaries and quick philosophical wit. After several years of exhaustive grief, we finally got our dad back, just in time for him to die. In the 8 months we had together from diagnosis to death, I walked alongside Dad on his death journey. I did show up regularly and willingly, and so did he.
We had philosophical and spiritual conversations about death. I called him every day until the cancer stole his ability to understand how to use his phone. I sat with him through all the hospice visits. I took meticulous notes. I took him to Culver's to get his fix of a fish sandwich and fries and a Coke, and learned how to hold my tongue at his dietary choices. Because honestly, what does it matter what a dying man eats? He's dying. I coordinated his increasing care needs. I moved him to a hospice home. I called the hospice team in when I recognized the signs of his entering the final stage of actively dying before they did. I called my siblings to come and say their goodbyes. I sat with him the night before he died and set up classical music to keep him company overnight and told him I'd be there first thing in the morning. I cradled his dead body the next morning, having missed his passing by 30 minutes. I lived 90 minutes away, and even though I sped, I couldn't get there on time. I did my best to show up for him in those last months, the way he always showed up for me whenever I needed him. Calm, cool-headed, logical, thoughtful, kind. To show him that he raised me well. I still find myself wondering if it was enough. Now, 8 months after his death, I find that Dad shows up for me in the same loving ways he used to before his mom died. Only now, I have to keep my heart open extra wide to recognize his visits, his assurances, his wisdom. He's in the hummingbirds he loved so deeply when he teaches me about releasing pain. He's in the pair of cardinals I love so deeply, who just started visiting our yard this winter, a rare sight this far north, when he teaches me about love. He's in the stunning display of northern lights high overhead last week, a rare sight this far south, when he teaches me about wonder. He's always right here when I need him, but thankfully, he never shows up uninvited to dinner.
Thanks to Leah Horton for sharing that on Stay Human. A couple of weeks ago, I was invited to sit in on a gathering of poets in Bemidji who share and critique their work together every month. RA, they call their group, I had to ask, stands for Writers Anonymous. I know. Everyone in the Bemidji area is still grieving the loss of their trees in last summer's storm, and of course, each loss recalls all our griefs. Here's Bemidji poet Marlis Gamaris.
Dear Mike, I load the wood stove with aspen and oak logs, stand before it to allow the radiant fire to warm bones, cold from loss, aching with age. My mind takes me to you cutting wood, dragging, bucking, filling sheds with the winter gold. I think of neighbors, family, and friends who took over when your body wasted, unable to move, your breath stopped. How they came, they cut, they carried wood, their bodies demonstrating words of comfort. The dead trees cut and split for firewood live on as energy heating this home. Their ash will feed soil and crops, regenerating life. Yesterday, when I filled the wood stove, I felt you and knew, like the trees that live outside my window, that you still exist as pure energy, creating a fire of your own, transformed, warming the air with your heat, like the breath of God.
Thanks to Marlis Gamaris. Sometimes at that Writers Anonymous gathering, someone brings a poem or two to share not written by them. Here's Mike Olson reading two poems by Sharon Olds. In the first, I go back to May 1947. The poet imagines witnessing the moment her parents meet.
I go back to May 1937. I see them standing at the formal gates of their colleges. I see my father strolling out under the ochre sandstone arch, the red tiles glinting like bent plates of blood behind his head. I see my mother with a few light books at her hip, standing at the pillar made of tiny bricks with the wrought iron gate still open behind her, its sword tips black in the May air. They are about to graduate. They are about to get married. They're kids. They're dumb. All they know is they are innocent. They would never hurt anybody. I want to go up to them and say, stop. Don't do it. It's the wrong woman. He's the wrong man. You are going to do things you cannot imagine you would ever do. You are going to do bad things to children. You are going to suffer in ways you never heard of. You are going to want to die. I want to go up to them there in the late May sunlight and say it. Her pitiful, beautiful, untouched body, his arrogant, handsome, blind face turning to me, his pitiful, beautiful, untouched body. But I don't do it. I want to live. I take them up like male and female paper dolls and bang them together at the hips like chips of flint, as if to strike sparks from them. I say, do what you are going to do, and I will tell about it.
That's Sharon Olds' voice.
Yeah.
That's a killer.
Yeah.
This next one, she talks about a situation where her father put her in what for her was a traumatic situation, uncomfortable, terrifying for her. And it reminded me of an incident that terrified me, with my father invariably left late to get to wherever. And he had a business meeting in Minneapolis. We lived 100 miles away. And so he would invariably speed, you know. We started late. So there's some small towns. He started speeding through these small towns, 50, 60 miles now. Of course, you know, I knew the cops could pull us over anytime, but he didn't bother me, just kept going. Got out on the road 60, 70, 80, 85, 90. Pretty soon he was going 120 miles an hour.
Oh my God.
I was in fourth or fifth grade. My sister was 3 years older in the back seat next to me, my mom in the passenger seat.
No seatbelts.
She was yelling at him and to slow down, and he would for a little while, and then he'd speed up again. And she gave up, you know, trying to get him to slow down. So I was afraid, because even by then I was an athlete. I'd started in grade school, and I was afraid we might get in an accident and I could lose an arm or a leg and I wouldn't be able to play sports anymore. But then in my childlike brain, I realized, no, if we get in an accident, I'll die. I'll be dead. So I don't have to worry about being maimed. And I could actually relax in the car going 120 miles an hour. You know, when I look at it today, I know that wasn't right. And what does a kid have to do? How much does he have to shut down, you know, to live in that kind of environment? And, you know, this is only a single story, but as someone has told me, it's part of a fabric of my life. So I've had to come to terms with that. And I have, you know, but it's taken a lot of work. So I'd like to share this poem by Sharon Olds, San Francisco. It reminds me of my experience riding in a car with my father. When we'd go to San Francisco, my father would seek out the steepest streets, despite my begging, offering him a month's allowance. He would sit behind the wheel and laugh with love. His face red as a lobster at Fisherman's Wharf after they drop it green and waving into boiling water. His black eyes would snap like seeds popping from a pod. His black hair would smoke in that salty air. He would tilt the huge nose of our car up and press on the gas. He would not look at me. We'd begin the ascent, nearly vertical, tires about to lose their grip on those slanted cobbles. He'd inch us up like an engineering experiment. We'd barely rise till we hung in space from nothing, like driving up an elevator shaft. The black pull of the Earth's weight sucking us back. He'd slow down more and more. We'd barely rise past buildings, pressed to the side of the precipice, like trees up the face of a cliff. As we neared the top, he went slower and slower, and then shifted into first, trying not to smile. And in that silence between gears, I would break, weeping and peeing, the fluids of my body bursting out like people from the windows of a burning high rise. We'd hit the peak, tilt level, and I wouldn't care. What was life when the man who had made my body liked to dangle it over empty space and tease me with death? He sat there sparkling, a refuse dump. I could smell his heat, the wheel loose in his hands now, the reins of my life held slack. We'd climb out, my knees shaking, and I stank, to look at the world spread out at our feet as if we owned it, as if we had power over our lives, as if my father had control of himself, or I of my fate. Far below us, blue and dazzling, the merciless, cold beauty of the bay. My whole saved life ahead of me.
That's a beautiful poem.
She Thank could do you. It.
Thank you.
Thanks to Mike Olson reading Sharon Olds' San Francisco to his friends at the Poets' Gathering. You are tuned to People Powered Radio, KAXE, KBXE, streaming at KAXE.org. That's where you can find local features, podcasts, news, and conversation. And while you're there, make a donation to help us keep this independent local service going. Today on Stay Human, friends and neighbors with end-of-life stories and poems, this next piece was written by my neighbor, Matthew Miltich, when his grandsons were little boys and had just had their first experience of a loved one's death. Matthew Miltich.
The leaf who wanted to be a bird. Once upon a time, a tiny bud near the very tip-top of a tall white oak tree began to feel a stirring. Very tiny and almost imperceptible at first. It came from beneath him where he was attached to his branch and felt like a vibration, as if a sound were beginning under him and trying to find its way into the air around him right through his little bud of a body. This stirring had a taste. It was a tiny bit sweet, as if he was tasting a candy too thin even to see. It felt cool, too, but not cold. He couldn't remember falling asleep, but he must have been asleep because these feelings were like waking up. He fell asleep again. When he woke, he felt the stirring stronger than ever, and it felt good. It was like stretching out your arms when you first wake in the morning, when you feel still only half awake and your muscles are stiff from sleep, but you're glad to be getting up. For a few days, he fell asleep every night when it began to get dark and woke again in the morning with each day's new light, and each time he woke, he felt stronger. He was growing, he began to understand, even when he was asleep, because almost every new day he was a little bigger and stretched out farther, and this felt wonderful, like coming out from under the blankets when you're ready to get out of bed. And then one night, he stayed awake all night, and in the morning he was no longer just a bud. He had opened up and unfurled and become a little leaf. He was green and smooth and had wonderfully scalloped edges. He could tell how handsome he was. He felt the sun shine on him. As it shone, it warmed him. It felt so good, he could tell he was actually growing larger little by little, and the first stirring of life he'd felt when he was just a tiny bud now became a steady hum, like some beautiful music coming through him, but it wasn't as if he only heard the music. No, it was as if he himself was the music. When the sun shone during the day, he felt warm and good, and when it grew dark at night, he felt cool and peaceful. And when it rained, he felt wildly happy because after the rain, he would taste a delicious sweetness all through his leafy body. Day by day, he grew, and as the wind blew, he fluttered. This was his happiest feeling of all. The wind blew him this way and that way, but he was so strong, and his attachment to his branch was so secure. It was as if he was on a wild ride, but so safe he never felt afraid. He lived high above the world, and he felt lucky and proud. All around him, the leaves of his family tree fluttered or garnered sunlight, and all seemed strong and good. One quiet, hot, humid afternoon early in summer, clouds gathered in great creamy billows which built upwards higher and higher, and the sky grew dark, though it was the very height of afternoon, and flashes of lightning forked through the clouds, and the whole sky boomed and rumbled. Suddenly the wind roared across the leaf in all of his family tree and all the trees of his forest. Some leaves were torn from their branches and swept away in the wind. Some branches broke and were hurled away, but the bud, who had become a leaf, though the wind tore at him, was held safe and secure by his branch high in the oak, and when the storm passed, the air became calm and clear once again. The heavy heat and humidity of the afternoon had been swept away, and the leaf and all the leaves of his family tree gleamed in the sunlight. Now they felt fresh and washed and cleansed, and the leaf, who had been terrified of the storm, was suddenly wildly happy. A leaf could survive such a storm and even feel refreshed by it. Storms came now and again, and though they were scary, yes, they were also exciting. The most exciting thing of all to the leaf, though, were the birds that visited or lived in his family tree. Birds came in many forms and many sizes and many colors. They played about in the branches or perched on them, and they fed upon the insects that sometimes crawled upon him or sometimes even took a bite of him, which didn't really hurt, but it was irritating. The birds sang so beautifully that the leaf vibrated with pleasure whenever they sang near him, and their colors were both startling and fantastic. The bluebirds had red breasts and bright blue heads and backs and wings. The indigo bunting was so blue it seemed almost to be electric, like blue lightning. The scarlet tanager, when it flew, was like a swift red arrow, a bright scarlet streak in the sky, and when it perched it was like a flame burning high in his tree. The little warblers came in so many colors and color combinations they seemed to be made of feathered jewels. But most fantastic of all, birds could fly. They might hold as tightly to his branch as he was held, yet they could also spring into the air and fly away. While he was fixed to his own branch of the family tree, the birds were free to fly to any tree they wished, or to visit the ground, or soar into the sky, or dart between the leafy branches. Their flights were so swift, birds in flight disappeared among the other leaves in no time at all, vanished without a trace. Some of the birds built nests in his tree, and in these they laid and incubated their eggs, and soon the eggs hatched into awkward, naked, helpless babies with big soft eyes and large beaks. The adults fed the baby birds, and day by day, the little ones grew feathers and became more and more like their parents. The leaf was full grown by the time the baby birds were fledged and ready to fly. The leaf felt conflicted. More than anything, he admired the flights of birds. If they could fly, why couldn't he? If those helpless little blobs, hatched only a few weeks before, were now grown up enough to fly, why couldn't he, a sleek, full-grown green leaf, be able to fly as well? The first flights of the baby birds were awkward, yes, almost more falling than flying, but with only a few practice flights, a few tumbles with flailing wings through the leaves and branches of his tree, they began to achieve controlled flight, and very soon even the most gawky and uncoordinated among them had mastered flight and were free to fly wherever they wished. This left the leaf longing for such freedom for himself, but no, he was firmly attached by his petiole to his branch of the family tree and held fast. He was not unhappy exactly, But he wished whenever he saw a bird take wing that he himself could fly. It would be better, he thought, to be a bird than to be merely a leaf, and so he wished he were a bird. As summer days passed, sunny days and cloudy, rainy days and stormy, humid days and dry, warm days and cool ones, the leaf's desire to be a bird stayed with him. He was not jealous, no. He merely admired the birds in their beauty and freedom and wished he could be one of them so he might know what it was to fly. And then the season began to change. The leaf felt this in the cells of his body, for where he had felt vibrant and moist, now he began to feel sleepy and dry, and the stiffness he'd known at waking now stayed in him through most of the day. His green surface changed and became nut brown. The birds began to feel the change too, as nights grew cooler and longer, and the sun rose in the morning day after day, more and more to the south, and went down behind the trees in the southwestern sky, where just weeks before it had gone down in the northwest. The birds gathered excitedly, talking among themselves, and whole flocks suddenly took flight, as if all the birds together were as one single body, and some of these winged away and did not return. New birds of shapes and colors the leaf had not known began to visit his family tree, and some of these stayed for only a little while, and some of them stayed longer. At every flight of every bird, the leaf wished he could fly too. Then, on a blustery cold afternoon in the autumn, the leaf felt suddenly the strangest sensation of his life. As the wind buffeted him, his stem began to wiggle loose from his branch. He was poised just for a moment, high in the tree with only the tiniest membrane of his pedicel holding him to the branch. The gust of wind swept across him, and all at once he was in flight. The leaf had not become a bird exactly, but he flew. A dizzying, twirling, dancing flight he'd taken. The wind boosted him high above his family tree, high above the forest family in which he'd grown and matured. He was ecstatic in a dry, cool sort of way to find himself, after his months of longing, to fly in actual flight. This, of course, did not last very long because, like a kite, and unlike a bird which has wings and muscles, he flew merely because his shape made it possible for the wind to lift and blow him about for a while. But the earth below, with its gravity, pulled at him, and he at it, and when the wind subsided for just a moment, he began to slide downward through the thin atmosphere, like a toboggan sliding down a steep hill. He careened through the air toward the ground. At the last second before he would touch down, a gust of wind lifted him once again for a giddy ride in the chilly air, and this happened several more times, and he was glad, but then, as was inevitable, he settled to earth finally in gentle touchdown amid many others of his kind, with many other kinds of leaves. He did not feel sad exactly, but mystified because he did not understand exactly what had happened to him. But he was very tired, so tired he couldn't stay awake a minute longer, and then he slept. The leaf woke every now and then to find many more leaves had fallen all around him, but he felt less and less. Nothing hurt. He was simply tired and wanted to sleep, and at last he fell into a dreamless slumber and knew nothing more. After who knows how long, a faint stirring prodded him awake. He was uncertain how long he'd slept, but it felt like a very long time. He tried to remember his life, but it was so faint in his memory he couldn't really make it out. All he really knew was the familiar stirring from beneath him, a faint sweet taste all through him, and the desire to expand and grow. He was a bud. It was spring. He was about to become a leaf again, but this time his family tree was a maple. This made him happy because the taste spreading through him was wildly delicious. In due time, he unfurled to become a very fine maple leaf on the twig of a branch halfway up a very tall sugar maple. When the birds began to appear and to perch in his tree and to build their nests, he had a very strange thought. It seemed to him this had happened before, as if he were remembering it. He found that he wished to be like the birds, to be able to fly, and he had the curious feeling he'd been wishing this from before he was even a bud, so that now the faintest memory of his life as an oak leaf came back to him now and then, just a little at a time. In the fall, he took flight once again and fell to the forest floor as before and slept. One year, he was a blade of grass. Another year, he was a purple aster. During each life, he dreamed of being a bird, for every summer he marveled at the beauty and freedom of birds. One spring, he awoke weak and soggy and warm, and trapped somehow beneath a smooth, round surface. He felt the familiar stirring of life. He did not quite remember how long he'd slept or how he'd come to be in this confined space, and he felt weak and small, but his desire to push outward, to expand, to grow, these strivings were strong in him, and so he pushed against the barrier that kept him inside itself, that enclosed and confined him. And little by little, weak as he was, he hammered against the smooth, curved walls within which he was held, and the hard surface began to give way finally. He slept for a few minutes when he was too tired to push anymore, but finally he pushed out, and suddenly he could breathe. He was free of his enclosure, but too weak to do anything but rest, and he was soggy and damp, but he felt warm, surrounded by soft, downy filaments, and he slept. When he awoke, he was dry and warm, but so weak he could hardly hold up his head. He was hungry, and someone fed him. He gulped his food and opened his mouth for more, and when he was full, he slept again. For several weeks, he ate and slept, but one morning, he felt very awake and very strong. He'd grown. He was in a round nest with three hatchlings, all about his own size. They had feathers, and so he found had he. He flexed his wings. He stretched his neck. He stood on his 2 feet. He was still very small, but he was a bird. He felt as if somehow, in this single moment, he'd become what he'd always wished to be. His siblings and he sat in their nest in the very tip-top of a white oak tree. He knew with certainty, and this made him very happy, that in almost no time at all, he'd be able to fly.
The Leaf Who Wanted to Be a Bird by Matthew Miltich. Up next, a poem from Grand Rapids storyteller, actor, poet, and sommelier and mixologist supreme, Nathan Bergstedt.
Borrowed. I borrowed my neighbor's lawnmower and was reminded that we're all only on borrowed time, are we not? Too many days go by when we're only too blinded by the golden sight that is solely of our own hot and heavy selves, kings under our own power. It's the beautiful illusion, the looking glass vision that gets us out of bed and into a hot shower, but in the end, it's just not true, so please listen. We didn't make our molecules. We didn't raise ourselves. We didn't write our history, nor do we craft our destiny. We're just the latest phase that the world sees in itself. Each body, me, you, only recycling air until into the grave I'll be lowered. All this to say that I will not be returning the mower.
Thanks to Nathan Bergstedt.
When I go down that funeral road, I'm gonna have a nice new suit and tie. One that I never could have afforded. I was alive. I ain't dead yet. Let me wear that suit right now. There ain't nobody gonna see it when I'm locked in that box underneath the ground. Well, I ain't dead yet. Give my flowers now. Song with a plant in the sand. And I ain't
time. When I go down that funeral road, there's gonna be flowers everywhere. Say all our friends are gonna send some just to show how much they can. Now I ain't dead yet, gonna have them flowers right now. I sure can't smell it when I'm in that box underneath the ground. Well, I ain't dead yet. Give me my flowers now. Well, I ain't dead yet. Give me my flowers now. Well, I ain't dead yet.
That's Charlie Parr speaking my language. I'm Michael Goldberg. My privilege each week to share this hour of words and music. Here's something from Southern Minnesota poet Susan Chambers.
What I want at my funeral. And there is an epigraph by David Eagleman. There are three deaths. The first is when the body ceases to function. The second is when the body is consigned to the grave. The third is that moment, sometime in the future, when your name is spoken for the last time. What I want at my funeral. A single sweet malt scotch for everyone to toast, each well-wisher, about every 5 minutes throughout the evening. Raise your glass to good poems, special music, everything that makes us laugh. Read poems. My favorites from Ted Kooser, Mae Sarton, William Stafford, Jane Hirschfield, Lee Young Lee. How can I name them all? There are so many. And from all those retreats, we must read yours. I want splashes of color. It could be flowers in huge purple vases. Maybe a cornucopia of artwork. Don't wear black. You in a red shirt, she in a blue dress, light up the whole room like a blazing rainbow. Raise your voices, croon Broadway musical numbers from Wicked, Stop the World, The Secret Garden. Make sure you sing along. I want sweet Celtic numbers with lots of harp. Belt out some blood, sweat, and tears. Use Adagio for strings, Opus 2 by Barber, as a grand finale. And it will be final, I guess. I know I won't be there to see what you actually do. I have to trust that you will make it a great party. To those in charge, please don't be cheap. Feed everyone a rousing first-rate dinner with an excellent chocolate dessert. Let them salute me one time at the end of the evening with the finest of libations. No speeches, but make sure people know I tried my best. When everything is done, take home some of my poems to read once more. Keep me from that third day.
Susan Chambers. That grand set of funeral instructions reminds me that I really want to get my papers in order. In particular, I'd like to plan some kind of show for my funeral, get in the last word one last time. The trouble is, for me to get around to doing pretty much anything, I kind of need a deadline. I do have one for this, but it's still TBD. But if, God forbid, I do ever die, I want to already have figured out how to say goodbye to the congregation. There's bound to be some kind of gathering, and I don't feel a need to plan that gathering. People will do what we always do at such times, laughter, tears. But after everyone who wants to has had their say, I'd like whoever's leading it to announce, as usual, Michael wants to get the last word. Cue the music.
Diddle, the cat and the fiddle, the cow jumped over the moon.
friends, I stayed human just as long as I could. Really, this funeral show won't be all that different from being on the radio. I'm already disembodied right now, just a flow of digital bits transmuted at transmission into invisible radio waves, transformed again at your receiver into sounds that you can hear, my voice creating the illusion that there's someone actually there with you. I haven't gotten around to figuring out this parting gift, let alone recording it, but in my mind, I've kind of got a rough draft. Mark Twain offered this for his gravestone. This rough draft has been returned to its author for further revisions. Maybe I'll include this poem by Minnesota poet Joyce Sutphen. Next time, I'll know the name of all of the birds and flowers, and not only that, I'll tell you the name of the piano player I'm hearing right now on the kitchen table radio, but I won't be in the kitchen. I'll be walking a street in New York or London, about to enter a coffee shop where people are reading or working on their laptops. They'll look up and smile. Next time, I won't waste my heart on anger. I won't care about being right. I'll be willing to be wrong about everything and to concentrate on giving myself away. Next time, I'll rush up to people I love, look into their eyes, and kiss them quick. I'll give everyone a poem I didn't write, one specially chosen for that person. They'll hold it up and see a new world we'll sing the morning in. And I will keep in touch with friends, writing long letters when I wake from a dream where they appear on the Orient Express. Meet me in Istanbul, I'll say, and they will. Joyce Sutphen. Yeah, I kind of like this idea of writing my own funeral, making a final stay human the last. Shouldn't be all that hard. I mean, it's not going to be 59 minutes long. Just a little something-something. For sure, I won't offer any words of wisdom or advice. Not even any of my favorite one-liners, like, don't believe everything you think, or everyone has two lives. The second begins when you realize you only have one. Nah, I'm not going to go there. When I write this thing, I think maybe it'll just be expressions of gratitude for all the babies born on the day I died, for all the sweet berries and fleet dragonflies, all the living beings I've seen, all the human stories I've heard. I think, really, what else will there be to say but thank you? And even though, really, I won't leave any words of wisdom or advice, I will end this thing with one last request to the gathering, and here it is. Turn the speakers up way loud and go out dancing.
Ooh. got to call them. Even the soldiers need a break sometime. Listen to the groove, y'all. Let it unwind your mind. No intoxication, unless you see what I see. Dancing hot and sweaty, right in front of me.
Right in front of me.
Oh, call me what you like. I'm a woman I be. This is just another one of God's gifts. Musicology. You got to keep the body moving, like I told you. Keep the old school joint for the true funk soldiers. Musicology. Wait a minute, babe. Wish I had a dollar for every time you say. Don't you miss the feeling music gave you back in the day? Let's groove, September. Earth, wind, and fire. Hot pants by James. Slides gon' take you higher. Minor keys and drums make a roller skate jam. Take your pick, turntable, or a band. Lord, if it ain't Chuck D, Jam Master J, know what they losing? Cause we got a PhD in advance, body moving. Keep the body moving, just like I told you. Kick the old school joint for the true funk soldiers. Musicology.
Thanks to Susan Chambers and to Matthew Miltich, Nathan Berkstead, Mike Olson, Marla Scamaras, Leah Horton, Jim Gallagher, and Henry Panovich for helping me to stay here. Laughing helps. Tune in on Saturday morning next at 9 o'clock. We'll have our live call-in joke show. And tune in this time every week on KAXE for story and song on Stay Human.
Of what you need the most, and that's time.